All right, 6:05 here on a Thursday. It's good to have you. And, boy, there was big news yesterday. Donald Trump signed that memorandum of understanding in France.
Everybody's not happy, though, are they?
No.
I mean, both sides. I mean, there's, you know, they're not very happy with that. Some people say it's not too far from the Obama deal.
Well, I'll tell you this. I think it is far from the Obama deal, and we'll explain a little later on in the hour. I was watching Fox News yesterday, and Trey Gowdy came on America Reports, and he said what I had been thinking. He goes, I read this, and I thought I was being punked. I thought this was a joke. And the details of this thing, I'll give you a couple.
Okay.
The U.S., Iran, and their allies agree to immediately and permanently end military operations on all fronts, including in Lebanon. Okay. The U.S. and Iran agree to respect each other's sovereignty and territorial integrity and not interfere with each other's internal affairs. Okay, pretty standard boilerplate stuff.
Yeah.
Then let's jump down here. The U.S. and regional partners will develop a mutually agreed plan of at least $300 billion for Iran's reconstruction and economic development.
Now, where is that money? Is that the United States? We're kind of managing that, but we're not putting our money in with that. Is that the Middle East countries that are going to be putting up that $300 billion?
Well, that's a fair question to ask because I asked that same question.
Okay, we're on the same page.
Well, the president said that not a dime of U.S. taxpayer dollars is going to be going to Iran.
Okay.
Well, last time I checked notes, Iran was taking fire at all of the Gulf neighbors, weren't they?
Yes.
So you're telling me Saudi Arabia is going to be willing to pony up $300 billion to help Iran out? I don't know. I have a hard time believing that.
Okay.
Then there's the issue of the nuclear dust, as the president calls it,
right. That
enriched uranium.
Yes.
Well, they're talking about downgrading the uranium, meaning it's not quite fully yet weapons grade. They're going to downgrade it.
Okay.
As opposed to destroying it or giving it away or doing something else with it. They're going to just downgrade it. So they get to keep the uranium under this memorandum of understanding.
And is it a possibility that they could enrich by a certain percentage?
If you can downgrade, you can upgrade.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
You take that same uranium.
I'm just checking.
And you can eventually upgrade it.
Okay.
Iran reaffirms that it will not procure or develop nuclear weapons and agrees to address its enriched material stockpile under the IAEA supervision.
Okay.
They also talk about the Strait of Hormuz being fully open for the next 60 days with no charge. 60 days with no charge, that doesn't mean that day 61 there won't be a toll.
Toll. Yeah. Okay. Possibility.
I don't quite know what this is. Now, the president said yesterday that if a deal that eventually gets done in this next 60 days isn't what he wants, they'll just go back to fighting.
The agreement now final, or are you still...
No, it's not final. It's a memorandum of understanding. And if I don't like it, we'll go back to shooting at them, dropping bombs on their head.
When do you expect the wording?
If I don't like it, if they don't behave, we'll go right back to dropping bombs right smack in the middle of their head. Okay? Because they've misbehaved for 47 years.
Yes.
All right?
Does it include immediate...
But nobody could have made this deal.
We're going to talk to Professor Saeed Khan, the professor of Near Eastern Studies at Wayne State University, coming up at 6:19. We'll get his perspective on what this means. It feels, Lloyd, to me, like this was somebody who was worried that things were getting out of control in terms of the economic impact here.
Yeah.
I mean, we were making an economic impact on Iran. There's no doubt about that.
But they seem to have a high tolerance for pain over there.
Well, they have a high tolerance for pain because they don't necessarily care about their people.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line.
That's the bottom line. Yeah, absolutely. That's why their pain tolerance is so high. They don't care.
So, again, we'll talk about it more coming up this hour.
Toledo police say a 20-year-old man has been arrested in connection with that mass shooting at the Old West End Festival that left a dozen people injured earlier this month. Officials say K'Nye Taylor was taken into custody Wednesday in Columbus, Ohio. He's facing 11 counts of felonious assault. He was wanted in connection with the June 6th shooting when gunfire erupted during the popular festival. It sent 12 people to area hospitals. Authorities say 9 of the victims have since been released, while the remaining 3 are in good condition. Investigators say several people have been identified as persons of interest, and they've obtained a photo of a possible second shooter. Police say Taylor will be returned to Toledo to face prosecution. A Detroit family demanding accountability after a lawsuit alleges a police officer opened fire into a crowded block party, shooting a teenager in the head and leaving her permanently disabled. The complaint filed Wayne County Circuit Court names Detroit police officer Verona Shaw and accuses her of gross negligence during the June 1st, 2024 response to reports of gunfire on the city's west side. According to the lawsuit, Shaw entered a backyard party without a flashlight, confronted a suspected armed man, then slipped on concrete steps and fired multiple rounds into the crowd while trying to regain her footing. 4 people were struck, including a 19-year-old Rain Williams, who suffered a gunshot wound to the head and shoulder, later a stroke that left her immobile and nonverbal. Another victim, Amani Peterson, died weeks after the shooting. Attorneys for Williams say body camera and forensic evidence show Shaw was the only officer firing. They also say she has since returned to duty while the family continues to seek answers and justice.
Sad.
I mean, you got to be careful, and you got to, those guns, man, the triggers are very fragile, and, you slip and you're trying to gather yourself, and it's an easy thing to do. And not saying it's the right thing or it's a good thing, but it's an easy thing to do. Michigan House Speaker Matt Hall continuing to raise concerns about the Gordie Howe International Bridge, saying Michigan got a raw deal in the long-running agreement that allowed Canada to fully finance the project. Hall argues the toll structure on the $4.7 billion span crossing to Detroit River should be renegotiated, and says the issue is tied to delays surrounding the opening of the new crossing between Detroit and Windsor. Former Governor Rick Snyder, who helped broker the original deal back in 2012, is pushing back. Snyder says the agreement was a great deal for nearly 10 million Michiganders, emphasizing that Michigan did not pay for construction and benefits from improved trade and infrastructure. Snyder also argues the only group that loses from delays is the owner of the nearby Ambassador Bridge, and says the focus should be on opening the crossing rather than reopening negotiations.
I don't understand why we're relitigating this.
I don't either. It's done. Everything's been done. The I's are dotted, the T's are crossed. It's done.
I understand that maybe you don't like it or whatever it is, whatever Matt Hall's rationale is, but it's not like it's halfway done.
Exactly.
I mean, there's light bulbs in every socket.
Oh, it's
ready to rock.
Exactly.
I don't know. I don't know why we
got CBP officers ready to go. Everybody's ready to go.
I don't know why we kicked the can down the road. Tigers lose again last night, 4-2 to the Houston Astros. 2 home runs. That was all the offense the Tigers could muster. Kevin McGonigal and Kerry Carpenter go yard. But there just wasn't a whole heck of a lot there. No, I mean, look, this is the problem with this team is the offense, it can come in clumps, right? You score 9 runs.
Sure.
And then you can muster 2. And you muster 4 runs in 2 games.
Yeah, well, consistency is you got to be consistent.
Yeah, and then that is something that they lack, certainly, is that consistency.
Yeah.
Professor Saeed Khan at Wayne State University joins us. We're talking the Memorandum of Understanding that was signed yesterday. It's Jared Morning. So we did get the information on the Memorandum of Understanding yesterday afternoon, and there is some boilerplate stuff on there. The U.S., Iran, and allies will end military operations. Everybody's going to respect sovereignty and territorial integrity. And then there's some more controversial things like the United States providing, or the United States and regional partners will develop a plan to provide at least $300 billion for Iran's reconstruction and economic development. There are some shoddy pieces of information here about exactly if Iran and Oman, for example, will be able to charge tolls for vessels traveling through the Strait of Hormuz. It was a bit of a letdown, quite frankly, at least from a U.S. perspective. Let's talk about it. Professor Saeed Khan, who teaches Near Eastern Studies at Wayne State University, joins us once again this morning. Professor, it's great to have you back. What were your initial thoughts when this information became available yesterday?
Well, thanks for having me on again, Chris. When I saw the draft of the memo of understanding, I must admit I was a little bit surprised that the United States not only agreed to this, but that the president was in fact so enthusiastic about it, because essentially what it did was it brought us not just back to the situation of how things were before February 28th and the start of this war, but really opened Iran up to the world when it came to lifting of sanctions and bringing it more into the global economy than it was over 100 days ago.
And the money aspect of it, and we can get to the munitions and the nuclear program in a second, but this $300 billion that's going to be provided for Iran's reconstruction and economic development, the president says that not a dime of U.S. taxpayer dollars will be used towards this. I'm curious to get your perspective on the neighboring Gulf countries that seemed to be, as the war went on, more and more perturbed at Iran for firing missiles into their territory. Are countries going to be jumping at the chomping at the bit to contribute this $300 billion towards Iran after what happened?
Well, to borrow from The Godfather, I think that this is an offer that they cannot refuse. After all, they are the neighbors of Iran. They not only see this agreement as being a de-escalation of the conflict in the immediacy, but they also see this strategically as, again, not just something that would bring about a cessation of hostilities among the countries, but also opportunities for these countries to trade with the largest single country in the region, one that certainly needs infrastructure development and is an important geostrategic country. On the issue regarding the United States and whether taxpayers are going to be on the hook for this, I must say that there's a lot of parallels between the president's proposal regarding the ballroom in the East Wing and this agreement. Somehow or the other, it is very difficult to imagine that the American taxpayers aren't going to be responsible for some of this. But again, as you were saying before regarding Oman and Iran, perhaps proposing a way for tolls to be taken, going through the Strait of Hormuz moving forward, that might be part of the way that the $300 billion is subsidized.
You talk about opening Iran to the rest of the world, these assets, these frozen funds that will be made available. And again, just for clarity's sake, this is a memorandum of understanding. This is not a final deal. This is essentially a framework to work on to get to a final deal, hopefully in the next 60 days. But now reopening these frozen assets, what does that provide for Iran at this point?
I think it provides for Iran much needed funding for its infrastructure. Remember that in the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran nuclear deal that came about during the Obama administration, which the first Trump administration revoked or pulled the United States out of, there was going to be the release of $150 billion in Iranian assets that have been frozen for the last 47 years in foreign banks, including those in the United States. There was every likelihood that that money was going to go into rebuilding the infrastructure of a country that's been under sanctions for 47 years. I'll give you just one example. Back in 2015, reports showed that Iran had a 900 commercial aircraft deficit for its aviation sector. There's only two major companies in the world that make the jets that would go ahead and supply Iran. One is Boeing, an American company, and the other is Airbus, which is a European conglomerate. That amount of money could have been used to then hire American workers, European workers. It was something that Iran would have desperately wanted. And that was just the aviation sector. That doesn't even include its travel and tourism, its other infrastructure needs. So this idea that people might be thinking that this money is going to somehow or the other go into funding illicit or improper activity seems to really be very remote.
And then the president's red line, which was that Iran will not have a nuclear weapon, that the nuclear program must be shut down. And he has talked frequently about the uranium dust, the enriched uranium that already exists in Iran. And it seems like that stockpile won't leave Iran. It will just be downgraded. But from what I've seen, that same uranium that gets downgraded can also be can be upgraded once again. So does this actually further the notion of Iran not having a nuclear weapon or nuclear capabilities?
So provision number 9 of the MOU says that Iran will maintain the status quo on its nuclear program, which ironically seems to suggest that even the United States has now acknowledged the many statements that Iran has made that it has not sought a military nuclear program and that this enriched uranium would be for civilian purposes. So you have, a very peculiar a memorandum of understanding. There's only 2 provisions which I see that could be seen as wins for the United States flat out. One is the opening of the Strait of Hormuz, which of course were open before the war began. Mm-hmm. And the other is provision 8, which says that Iran will not ever produce nuclear weapons, which it had already pledged back in 2015. So we really have to wonder then whether this is seen as a net positive. Now, for the Trump administration, it seems that despite what were the motivations and the objectives sought going into the war on February 28th with Israel, now it seems as though the Trump administration has a different metric for victory, which is, again, opening up the Strait of Hormuz and getting yet another assurance from Iran that it's not seeking a military nuclear program. If that's the case, then it certainly is a win for the White House.
Oh, interesting stuff. Always great insight. Professor Saeed Khan, thank you so much for your time. As always, we appreciate it, and we'll talk again soon.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Yeah, you got it. The other part here, what something that I do not see in the memorandum of understanding is the continuation of funding for proxy groups like Hezbollah, which Israel has been focusing on for several weeks. We're going to continue this conversation coming up next, give you some additional thoughts and some more information. It's next on JR Morning. All right, 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. You can call or text as we talk about this memorandum of understanding and what this means. And I'll give you my perspective, Lloyd, because I want to hear what you think, too.
Okay.
I thought the JCPOA was fine when it was signed. Things changed. That was 2015?
It's a different time.
Completely different time.
It's a different time. Different circumstances.
Different circumstances. Mm-hmm. Now, Iran was continuing to enrich uranium under the JCPOA.
Absolutely.
That was happening. But pretty quickly, the president got in his first term and squashed that deal.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly Iran didn't seem like they were halting their nuclear ambitions. And so the president gets out of the JCPOA. Things really escalate in Iran in terms of their enrichment capabilities.
Right.
And then the president goes and makes the decision to go into Iran military action alongside Israel and back in late February. And now here we are.
Yeah.
And in the months that have passed, we have seen service members die.
With 12, I believe it is.
We have seen an economy, inflation is up.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen gas prices go sky high.
Yep.
Not record highs,
nope.
But they've gone up.
They're going up high. And,
now they're coming down.
Coming down now.
Mm-hmm. And the overall sentiment is pretty low on the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And recent polling shows that most Americans aren't on board with the direction of the economy at this point. And again, it's a poll. It's a small sample size of people. But it's a little snapshot. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, could this deal end up being better than the JCPOA? Sure. Of course it could.
If we follow through and we do what we say we're going to do and Iran does what they say they're going to do.
But
I don't trust Iran, but we just have to be on top of them.
But we have to talk about what we know. Now, we can forecast. We can give our opinion on what we think is going to happen.
Right, but we, yeah.
But this is not a final deal. And I'll just say, it feels like a capitulation here.
Okay.
It feels like the Trump administration,
are we kicking the
president,
can?
Well, I don't know if we're kicking the can. I don't, if this is what the framework of this deal is going to look like, I don't know that we've kicked the can. I think we've just, I think we've completely caved.
And we didn't get what we went in to do. What we needed to do? What we said we were going to
do. I don't know that. I don't know if we've accomplished what we wanted to accomplish. Now, again, you go back to what this says in the memorandum of understanding.
Yeah.
What was the one thing we wanted to accomplish?
No nuclear weapons.
No nuclear weapons. Well, in line 8, Iran affirms it will not procure or develop nuclear weapons and addresses and agrees to address its enriched stockpile of uranium under the IAEA supervision. That would be the most, the biggest point in all of this. But you're talking about $300 billion going to Iran. You're talking about easing sanctions, easing restrictions. You're talking about unfreezing assets that have been frozen for many years. All of a sudden, Iran is opened up a bit.
Yeah.
Things have changed economically for them overnight.
Sure.
And not to mention that you're reopening the Strait of Hormuz.
And
all of a sudden, those hundreds of millions of dollars are starting to roll in.
Yeah.
The thing that I don't like also is that at the end of this 60 days, is Iran and Oman going to be charging tolls to get through? Is this $300 billion a part of those tolls? We don't have those answers yet. We can speculate, but that's all we can do.
Right.
The president talked about monitoring the nuclear development program that Iran has yesterday at his G7 press conference. And he says that they're going to keep a close eye.
But nobody's touching it. We also have cameras. That's what Space Force is. We have the best. We have the greatest military in the world, by the way. But I'm proud of Space Force because I started it. We have Space Force cameras on every single door. Well, there are no doors. They've been pretty well shattered. But every area of that. If somebody walks in and he's got a badge with his name on it, like Mohammed something, which is about a 50-50 guess, Mohammed something. They can tell the name. They can give you a serial number. We can see things you wouldn't believe, the quality of the stuff that we have. That's why we've been so successful. That's why our blockade will go down in the annals of history as being unbelievable. Nobody's ever seen a blockade like that. It's like a steel wall.
Okay. Here's why I think the capitulation part comes into play.
Okay.
Because one of the things he also said yesterday was that he was motivated to finalize the memorandum motivated to finalize the memorandum of understanding with Iran to prevent, quote, economic catastrophe if the war was not resolved soon. So rather than possibly going into a depression, rather than having your favorite president be Herbert Hoover, he was always the one I didn't want to be. I didn't want to see economic catastrophe. If you keep this going, that could have happened. But all I know is every time we talked about the possibility of peace, the stock market shot up like a rocket ship.
Okay. Yeah. So I see where you're coming from now.
It feels like the economic pressures, the political pressures at home might have finally played a role.
Got to him. Yeah. And what do you think about, and I know maybe he said this as a joke, but what do you think about the fact that, well, if this goes right, I'm going to take the credit, but if it goes wrong, I'm going to blame JD.
Look, that is the...
Was that a joke or was that not kind of, but really was, but not really?
Well, I'll tell you this. Know? I think that is the least of my concerns at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Because
he just wanted to get this done, walk away from it, and hopes it goes well, and if it doesn't, you know, because he likes to be right and likes things to go right for him. And it just seems like, I don't know, it's almost like he just wanted to get this out of the way so I could either move to work with the Russia and Ukraine or deal with Cuba or do something else.
Ben Shapiro was on with Martha McCallum last night, and he said, I don't think that J.D. Vance, as the vice president and the lead negotiator on this issue, served the president well.
Well, I mean, you know, he went in and did what he did, and he told the president okayed it.
Here's another issue. the ballistic missiles. So that you have the nuclear program and the ballistic missiles. Let me play a little audio from Marco Rubio back in March.
The agreement now.
Wrong one, fat fingers. Here's Marco Rubio back in March.
The purpose of this is to destroy that missile capability. Why does Iran want that ballistic missile capability? What they are trying to do and have been trying to do for a very long time is build a conventional weapons capability as a shield where they can hide behind, meaning there would come a point where they have so many conventional missiles, so many drones, and it can inflict so much damage that no one can do anything about their nuclear program. That is what they were trying to do, is put themselves in a place of immunity where the damage they could inflict on the region would be so high that no one can do anything about their nuclear program or their nuclear ambition.
President says something a little different, though.
Fast forward to Donald Trump yesterday at the G7.
So we'll be working on a parallel effort with the Gulf nations to address non-nuclear issues, such as the conventional ballistic missiles, which we'll be talking about, and support them. I mean, they have to have some because other people have some. You got to have some. Somebody said, you shouldn't give them one. I mean, I have guys, I like some of these guys. But I don't think they're smart. Sir, you shouldn't let them have any missile. I said, well, what am I going to do? Am I going to let Saudi Arabia have missiles, but they can't have them? Yes, sir. It doesn't work that way, you know? It doesn't work that way. And missiles aren't the problem. Missiles are, they hurt a little location, but they don't blow up the planet.
Okay. A big difference there.
A big difference.
That's, you know. And that really sounds like capitulation right there.
3 months. Yeah. Yeah. So this is why I'm a little confused by this memorandum of understanding.
Now, a lot of people are.
Again, this is not the final deal. So we need to wait for what that looks like.
Sure.
But right now, this is not what I had expected to come out of this.
No.
And it does kind of further this. We talked about it when that first memorandum of understanding came out.
That's right.
Which it's like, well, why are we allowing this discussion to be put off until after the Strait of Hormuz is open? Iran shouldn't call the shots here.
No.
Why are we allowing that to go on? Well, maybe it's the economic pressures that have bubbled up beyond where the president is feeling comfortable with it. Mm. Coming up on the other side, kids get out of school, their routine goes out the window. How can that adversely affect their mental health? We'll talk about it. It's JR Morning. I was trying to tell my kids, I said, you guys get a summer vacation. I think parents should get a winter vacation.
I'll be down with that. I'll be good with that.
That way, you get your time
off,
but then we get our time off while you're in school.
Yeah.
How about that? We got to go work, and you're on summer vacation, and now we're off when you're in school. How about that? They didn't like that.
Of course they don't.
But at this time of year especially, and I'll tell you, I remember as a kid myself, like, boy, when that first day of summer hit, I don't remember anything I learned.
Oh, no.
It was.
Oh, dude. It was gone.
And I'm all my routines are shot.
Everything.
Sleeping in.
And by
whatever.
The time school starts back up, you're going through all
kinds
of.
You're like, what?
Yeah, I know it. Yes.
2 + 2 is what?
I got to go to bed at what time?
We need a refresher course here. You know how you watch a Netflix show at a new season and they give you a recap?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
I need a recap.
You need
on this first day? We need to run this thing back a little bit. But the realities are, what happens when kids are off of school? Well, you probably get increased screen time. The routine is completely out of whack. You get bored, anxious, get a little more clingy. Your parents are around more often. Everybody's a little more on edge. And so that can certainly have an impact
breakfast
on
and
kids.
Lunch changes a lot of times.
Absolutely, you know? Certainly. Mm-hmm. Dan McMahon is the executive director of the Great Lakes Learning Academy and joins us this morning to talk about it. Dan, good to have you.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing?
We're good. What have you seen from kids around this time of year? And then once they get back into school, what type of impact does, aside from the rest and relaxation of a summer for these kids, what are some of the things that they have to deal with?
Well, I think one of the things that we don't pay attention to is just the additional anxieties and stress that actually our kids can go through in the summer. Yes, they can stay up later. They hopefully can turn the alarm off in the morning. They get to sleep in a little bit later to kind of make up for that. But there is a lot of anxiety, right? Because their social experiences are at that school when they're out there all day. So you have to kind of be able as a parent to plan for that a little bit and try and support that and work on, okay, how do you make sure they are getting those opportunities and doing things? Because even though it's fun, even though it's summer, how long until you start hearing, hey, I'm bored. What are we doing now? What's next, right? So that's one of the things that parents have to plan for.
You know, you described the traditional school calendar as a cliff drop into summer. What does that look like from a student's perspective?
It is sudden, it is quick. There's a lot of that immediacy of, okay, what are we supposed to be doing now? I mean, in my own household, I hear it all the time. What are we doing next? What, and then what, and then what, and then what? Because they're used to that scheduling. You know, our kids go from that 8 to 4, you know, and then all of a sudden, hey, we also go to activities afterwards. So you might have an hour between the activity and you're coming home and rushing to dinner and doing all these things. They're used to that kind of the drama of speed, speed, speed. And so when you hit summer, they don't know what to do. Their bodies slow down. Their bodies are going, okay, now what am I supposed to do at this point? So there's that high anxiety, that high stress inside. So it's important to kind of work through different aspects of that as you go through and build a different routine for the summer.
Is it important to kind of keep a same sleep schedule? Like you mentioned, kids will stay up a little later, get up a little later. But how important is that rhythm for them just to stay somewhat in that balance?
Normally you have a few months. You know, you have a few weeks to go through and your activities change. So it's not maintaining that same rhythm. It's letting the students get into the rhythm that their body is asking for, right? So that's why if you could turn that alarm off in the morning, let them sleep in until they naturally get up, they'll get into that new rhythm. You know, you're just talking about when it's coming back and you have to do that remediation at the start of the year. And, you know, now you got to go to bed earlier. That doesn't take long to get into. That could be a week, you know, that you go through. So let your child just kind of get into that rhythm of what naturally works for them and then build things around that experience. That's the biggest part.
Then you got a lot of students, though, who want to work summer jobs. They want to participate in sports. They want to travel. They want to spend a little time with the family. How does flexibility allow them to do those things while still maintaining, you know, structure and purpose?
Well, that's the thing, right? It's balance. It's balanced from the beginning. We balance the schedule, balance those pieces. When you have those older students that are doing the jobs and working through all the time, and you know, right now you got summer camps that are happening all the time. It is that structure that still has to take place. So that's actually a good part because it is when they go to those camps and they do that work, you just have to make sure that you're consistent with making sure that all these things happen. You know, you mentioned earlier about being on the phones all the time, setting some limits for screen time, trying to set time where it's just socialization, family dinners. You know, even not every day, but just making sure there's opportunity to sit down and talk and ask them what's going on and make sure you're getting inside the kid's head as well and seeing how are they feeling about that specific moment and that specific day.
And, you know, we often hear about the summer slide as well academically. Should we also be talking more about the mental health slide during the summer months?
I think so. You know, it's just that overbooking of things. You know, we have graduation parties that come up, 4th of July holiday parties, and we're like, oh, I don't want to miss out on anything. It's okay to miss out on some things. You know, allow a parent to step back and just kind of have those opportunities to say, all right, let's relax a little bit. This is a day where we're not doing anything major. And they kind of do that spot. But yeah, those check-ins are definitely important to help prioritize some self-care. And what does that look like? I mean, the biggest thing is getting up, walking, exercise, making sure there's some movement going through there. I have some older students, older kids in my house here that would do just sitting, they call it bed rot, right? They're going to lay in bed all day, sit on the phone and do nothing else. And we have to discourage that as much as possible.
Yeah,
all right,
yeah.
Get out of there now. We're moving. We're doing something different.
Dan McMahon, we appreciate your time and insights on this. My 8 and 4-year-olds will not like this interview. Thank you. We appreciate you.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
You got it. Wow. You got it. Meanwhile, an LGBTQ organization in Kalamazoo issued a public statement about two volunteers at this Pride Festival in Kalamazoo.
Yeah.
They say they were wearing harmful symbols. They wore an Israeli flag as a skirt and an Israeli hat. And these were people supporters of this group, and they put out a statement. For LGBTQ people with family, heritage, or lived experience connected to Palestine and the broader region, including Lebanon, Syria, and other communities impacted by Israeli military actions, these symbols cause deep trauma and we will do better to avoid pain caused in this incident.
Wow.
Terrible. 7 o'clock hour coming up. We get a visit from Dr. Steve Craig. All that and more coming up on JR Morning. All right, 7 o'clock hour. Good to have you. That memorandum of understanding was signed by Donald Trump yesterday in Versailles. And there are a number of elements to this, including the United States and regional partners developing a mutual agreed plan of at least $300 billion for Iran's reconstruction and economic development efforts.
Fixing what we blew up?
Yeah, essentially, which isn't totally uncommon, but the president has maintained that no U.S. tax dollars are going to be used for that.
We'll see.
Again, if that's what you say.
Yeah.
But where that money comes from, I guess I don't really care as long as it's not coming from us.
That's right.
Right. The U.S. Treasury is going to issue waivers for Iran crude oil, petroleum products and derivatives and associated banking, insurance and transportation services. The unfreezing of Iranian funds and assets, which will be fully available for Iran's use at this point. It was a strange MOU. I did not expect that this would be what was in there. Now, again, this isn't the deal. It's not the final deal. It's basically the framework for what that deal will look like in 60 days. Hopefully we get to that point in 60 days. Mm-hmm. There's an option for an extension of it and those things.
Right.
But the president says if things don't work out the way that they want it to, well, then they could just go back to the military action.
Is the agreement now final, or are you still...
No, it's not final. It's a memorandum of understanding. And if I don't like it, we'll go back to shooting at them, dropping bombs on them.
But when do you expect the wording?
If I don't like it, if they don't behave, we'll go right back to dropping bombs right smack in the middle of their head. Okay, because they've misbehaved for 47 years.
Yes, sir.
All right?
Does it include immediate...
Nobody could have made this deal.
Hmm.
Okay.
So we continue to watch, but this memorandum of understanding has been met with skepticism.
On both sides?
Yes, to say the least.
Yeah. An Oakland County mother accused of abandoning her children in Pontiac in that home now faces continued legal proceedings after a new court... update in her case. Kelly Bryant was in court yesterday for sentencing on welfare fraud charges and a competency review tied to separate child abuse allegations. She was sentenced to 2 years of probation on the fraud counts. Prosecutors say Bryant's three children, ages 15, 13, and 12, were found living alone in squalid conditions last year, with garbage reportedly piled several feet high, mold, feces throughout the home. Authorities say the children were left to survive on food deliveries but lack basic hygiene supplies. Bryant has also been charged with first-degree child abuse, and yesterday a judge ruled she is competent to stand trial. Her child abuse case is now scheduled for August 24th of this year.
Hmm.
And so we were waiting for that kind of figure that they were going to come back and say she was competent to stand trial. That's good, and so we'll see what happens.
Hmm. Meanwhile, the Luigi Mangione case, his team is going to present a psychiatric defense at his state murder trial. At a hearing, the judge said that he planned to unseal records related to an affirmative defense available to New York State criminal defense charges with murder, in which the accused admits to the charged conduct, but they argue that they should not be held fully criminally liable because they acted while experiencing a mental health episode.
So with this defense, he could go to a mental institution as opposed to jail?
Correct. And you've got experts saying legal experts saying that it would be a challenge for Luigi Mangione to prove this. But at the same time, it's probably the best route that they have to go.
Yeah, for him. Yeah.
The kind of insanity perspective.
Public school districts across Michigan could soon expand hands-on learning opportunities under a bipartisan education plan approved unanimously by the Michigan House. The 107-0 vote sends forward a two-bill package that would allow districts to create a so-called innovative program focused on career and technical education, internships, apprenticeships, and other work-based learning options. The program could also qualify for seat time waivers, easing traditional classroom hour requirements. Supporters, including former Governor Rick Snyder and former Governor John Engler, say the goal is to better prepare students for the workforce with skills like problem solving, communication, and collaboration alongside academics. Snyder says the traditional system is
outdated and argues students need more real-world experience to succeed in today's economy. The proposal now heads to the state Senate for their consideration.
Mm. Tigers lose consecutive games, both 4-2. They lost to the Astros last night, 4-2. And it was Kerry Carpenter going yard, as did Kevin McGonigal. And that was it. All they could muster up. Mm. Just three total hits as a team last night.
Two of them being home runs.
Yes.
Well, I mean, you know, the bats, you know, they wake
cold.
Up. They wake up some days, and some days they go to sleep.
It's like kids on summer vacation. Exactly right. 7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan. Stop it. The founder and CEO of Startup Nation.
Let me talk to you.
The entrepreneurial tech and startup community here on WJR.
Good morning. Consumers are relying on AI for what seems like, well, everything these days, and for good reason, because that is the new reality. We are relying on it for just about everything, even when it comes to managing our personal health care. That, according to a just-issued 2026 Patient Choice Report from healthcare reputation management firm Rater 8, and as reported by Media Post, reliance on AI to choose a healthcare provider has more than doubled in the past year, from 17% a year ago to 36% this year, completely upending traditional methods like search engine marketing and referrals from other doctors. The report found that 47% of respondents have used AI tools like ChatGPT, Claude, Perplexity, or Google's AI overviews to research providers, up from 31% in Rater 8's prior research done 9 months earlier. And one surprising finding, more 45 to 60-year-olds, 64%, than any other age group reported actively using AI to find their providers. Only 28% of 18 to 29-year-olds did so, for example. A possible explanation, according to Media Post, thanks to most Google searches now automatically triggering AI overviews, the report states, patients aren't necessarily choosing to use AI, rather it's being placed in front of them. Not only are Google AI overviews growing in use, but patients are trusting them more, which directly affects the search engine marketing. And when asked which section of Google search results they most trust, AI overviews have now overtaken traditional organic links among survey respondents. Now, the Patient Choice Report is based on a survey of over 1,000 U.S. patients over age 18 conducted in April via SurveyMonkey. So there you have it. AI continuing to permeate everything, now even deeply embedded in the process of finding healthcare providers. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
All right, I feel like it's been a couple of weeks since we've seen the good doctor.
I know.
So
welcome back.
That's right. That's right. Dr. Steve Craig is in the house. What's up?
We had to first work on Chris a little. We haven't seen him in a while. Right. I think I'm done for the day.
I'll tell you.
Right.
I'm surprised this guy hasn't billed me at this point.
I'm telling you, man. Wow.
I walk in. Hey, I got one for you. Right. Okay, let's go with the real one today.
Yeah, okay.
Dr. Steve, as a woman executive, a year ago, I was told in my annual review that I was too assertive. My boss said that I can be intimidating and have strong opinions and that some of my superiors, whom all are men, found it off-putting. It was hurtful, and I took it personally. Nonetheless, I agreed to tone it down, and over the past year, I've been much quieter at meetings and have let things slide I otherwise would have addressed. But now I feel powerless and ineffective, and at this year's review, I was told that my visibility and clout around the office and at our headquarters in Chicago has been diminished. It feels like I just can't win. I'm a woman struggling to thrive in a male-dominated career field. What do I do when I can't win, even when I embrace the specific feedback I'm given that's supposed to help me advance? And that's from someone named Jane.
Well, your superiors are telling you this. Well, I think, first of all, I think you don't become a smaller version of yourself. And, I mean, the people, she's an executive, so I'm sure she has people under her. Have they been complaining? It doesn't say that in this letter. Have they been complaining? It's just been her superiors who've been complaining, who are all men, who feel like, you know, you're a woman, you're not supposed to be strong like that. You're supposed to be a little bit more timid. And she's just doing her job. And I just think, you know, you just don't confuse your voice with a flaw. I think that she should
continue to be strong. And as long as she is not, you know, being disrespectful to her superiors and her, the people that follow her that are under her are, you know, respect her and, you know, are respectful of what she's doing. I think you continue that. I think, you know, they were just trying to knock her down because she was a woman and felt like, you know, that's not a woman's place to be assertive.
Chris, right. His brow is all furrowed. I didn't know where to go with this, right?
So okay, I'll take a little bit of a different approach.
Okay.
I think it's her perspective, or she believes that because of her superiors being men, that it has something to do with gender. But she's an executive, which means I can't imagine her work style has changed, meaning that you got to be an executive because you worked hard and you did what you needed to do. So it almost feels like it's her perspective that because she's a woman and her bosses are men, that has something to do with it. I'm not sure that that's totally how I would read it. I don't think it would be appropriate to change your style. I think you take the feedback and, mm-hmm. and there are maybe you can you know, pick your time to maybe change your approach a bit. But I don't know that being quieter in meetings or letting things slide on a consistent basis mm-hmm. would reach the goal that she wants. And now she says that, you know, she's maybe not looked at quite as important. I don't know, around their headquarters. I don't think I would have capitulated to that ask completely. Yeah. I think I would have picked my battles a little bit.
Well, Chris, you're too assertive. That's the problem. Right. But that's really the setup for my question is, how many times have either one of you been told you were too assertive? Zero.
Yeah.
Zero.
Yeah.
Me too. And that's part of the problem here. I mean, I'm a male. I'm an executive coach. I'm a doctor. I've been CEO of companies.
What's your business card look like?
It's like a scroll. Like a,
right, right, right. Exactly.
Right. But I've never been told I was too assertive. But you hear this all the time. Women are often told they're too assertive, and I can barely find a man who's ever told that. That's really the heart of this problem, is that's a tragedy. Why does that occur? Because assertiveness, you guys were getting at, is a winning skill. Mm-hmm. As a coach, I'm teaching people to be assertive all the time. Why does it show up that sometimes we're told, but you're too assertive? That's like saying you're too smart.
Right.
You're too creative. You're too funny. You're too something. Uh-huh. So, you know, but we have to look at why are women told that rather than men, which is really bothers me the most.
So you do think the gender thing here plays a role?
Something about that, because men don't hear it. So, I mean, I'm just, it's a straw poll, but, you know, if I coached 100 people and 40 of them were told they were too assertive, 40 of them were women, you know, like it never happens to men.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be something there. But like you said, we have to take her word for the fact, you know, just a caveat that she's not aggressive and rude and disrespectful to people. If we're talking assertiveness, which is defined as clearly, directly speaking your mind, defending your boundaries, what's wrong with that?
Right.
That's a wonderful skill. But sometimes when we're told that, especially because sometimes what we do to women is we kind of scold them for that,
mm-hmm.
that they're being told, well, that's a problem. And I would, if I were coaching her, sometimes as a coach, my job is to read your reviews and have you get a thought about it. My answer would have been that she should have said, well, thanks for noticing. Like that's a good skill.
Yeah.
You don't have to take it in and go, oh, I got to change. I got to do whatever. And that was the problem right there. When she was told that, I wish she would have said in her head, good, I'm breaking the rules around. I'm doing something around here. Thanks for noticing. Instead of how we've socialized people to think that that's bad.
Yeah, and I think probably may have felt like those, by them telling her that they were telling her, you need to.
Well, right. And it's completely dejecting when you go from, you know, being this position of power and all of a sudden like, oh, we don't look at you the same.
Right, right. So we
it's
have
a
to,
no-win.
We have to also recognize that all reviews are done by humans and they're biased. So
subjective.
Right.
Yeah.
I have read many reviews, and we are told that reviews are created to help us, but sometimes help is just the sunny side of control.
Yeah.
Do you know what
uh-huh.
I mean? It's just trying to figure out what to do here. And if you understand organizational dynamics, no matter what we say, the group is always trying to stay in homeostasis, to stay how we were, resist change. So, I mean, we say we want to change this company, but man, anyone who starts pushing the boundaries, everyone's like, oh, no, this is how we work.
Right. Yeah.
So sometimes a review points out that you're the person who's actually forcing change.
Right.
That you're making everyone uncomfortable because you're not following the same old stupid rules.
That's right, right.
And so that's why you need to see when you're heading into your review, some of the things you're going to be told. There's a friend of mine, Jane, who always says, you know, not all pimples, not all blemishes are a big problem. Like sometimes you just ignore things.
Sure.
It's okay.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes you go into it and just go, well, they're gonna point out things where I'm breaking the rules around here. Good for me. Thanks for noticing.
Yeah.
That's what she should have done.
Great point. Great point. Dr. Steve Craig, good to see you again. And thank you.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yes. See you guys.
See ya.
All right.
We'll take a break. Get you caught up on the headlines. Come back for more on JR Morning. So Ford Motor Company, marking a major milestone toward its next EV platform, it started production of their prismatic cells. It's a new slurry to coating formation, and it all helps their EV battery production. Let's talk about it with Brianna Noble, the auto and business reporter for the Detroit News. Brianna, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So well, first of all, what is Ford doing here? And then is this a solution to the price problem for electric vehicles?
Yeah, great question. So Ford has started what is called D-sample production at their Marshall battery plant. D-sample is one step after C-sample, which means that they're one step closer to launching actual production of cells that could go into production vehicles.
Yeah.
This means that they're using all of the material that would go into production batteries. The batteries are, you know, going through the whole system, but it's just a step towards producing cells for validation and testing right now that will be used in their next generation electric vehicles, starting with an all-electric midsize pickup that is set to launch next year. And on the question of affordability, yes, these are specifically lithium iron phosphate batteries, which don't use more costly materials like nickel and cobalt, and that will significantly help to reduce the cost of electric vehicles, since batteries represent the most significant cost in an EV.
Because this, Brianna, is really, you know, kind of a turning point, I would think, in the global EV race, because these batteries could help it, you know, Ford compete with the lower cost Chinese EV.
Yes. So there already are LFP batteries that exist in available vehicles on the market today, including Ford's own Mustang Mach-E. However, these are the first LFP batteries that are being produced in the United States for automotive application. And so right now, the LFP batteries that are in the market are coming from China. So this allows the United States to have a production of LFP batteries that don't rely necessarily on the Chinese supply chain. And that's been really emphasized by Ford executives as important for supply chain resiliency and national security.
What kind of cost cutting are we looking at here? Are we looking at maybe offsetting the incentives that are no longer there for electric vehicles? Are we talking about $15,000-$20,000? Like how significant would this savings be to buyers?
It can be very significant. The battery of an electric vehicle can represent as much as 40% of the cost of total cost of the vehicle. Ford has already communicated that the midsize pickup truck that they're planning on launching next year is expected to have a starting price around $30,000. Right now, the average price of a electric vehicle is closer to the $60,000 range. So this represents much more accessibility for consumers.
So the plant already employs about 500 people, could eventually reach 1,700 jobs. You got 11,500 people who applied for jobs, production operator wages, $27 an hour, technicians above $46 an hour. One of the workers described the plant as futuristic, touchscreens and autonomous vehicles and strict cleanliness standards. Is this what the next generation of auto manufacturing was going to look like?
Yeah, definitely. This is a plant that looks a lot different than a traditional, you know, manufacturing plant that people may have seen or, you know, taken a tour of the Rouge. This plant is highly automated. A lot of the employees are working directly with robots and are being trained in how to, like, human-machine interface technologies. And so there's a lot more technical expertise that is often required for these types of positions. The folks who are being hired for these roles, you know, they go through a series of classroom work and then also hands-on work as well in terms of their training. And there's different levels that you know, operators go through in order to sort of progress along the way until they can sort of operate the machines independently. And Ford has received training help from CATL, which is a major producer of electrical vehicle batteries in China. The company is licensing technology from CATL to produce these batteries. However, that's the extent of their partnership. This isn't a joint venture or anything like that. These workers are completely Ford employees. Ford completely owns the operations of the plant as well.
Mm. I was going to bring that up. I'm glad you brought it up, because this connection to China, that was one of the big criticisms of these EV productions in the first place when it was coming to Michigan, was the Chinese connection. And Ford says that, as you write in your piece, Ford has said it allowed it to reshore the supply chain otherwise that would come from China. So are we seeing a transition to where Ford is going to be able to build these batteries all by themselves without that connection to China?
Yes. So the technology itself is a licensing agreement with CATL, which is based in China. Mm-hmm. So that is a part of the manufacturing of these cells. However, it's being completely done by Ford. Ford also has emphasized the materials that are going into the batteries are completely sourced from friendly nations around the world as well. And so they've really emphasized that this effort is something that is being done in order to create a domestic supply chain versus relying on the foreign production of these LFP battery cells. Ford is the first to be able to produce that type of chemistry for the EV application.
Mm. Brianna Noble, great stuff. Great piece in the Detroit News. We appreciate your time as always. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, you got it. Meanwhile, General Motors and Ford are positioning themselves to capture a share of the U.S. defense manufacturing build out. And that's something that we've seen, obviously, with Selfridge. The defense side of things is really coming to Michigan as well.
Mm-hmm.
And this is obviously with everything that's going on. Obviously, our history is the arsenal of democracy during World War II.
Yes.
And we are now being looked again as a military production hub. And analysts are saying that hundreds of billions of dollars in potential government contracts are on the table for automakers to show what they're doing. GM is already aggressively pursuing new partnerships with Lockheed Martin, for example. And this production would include a wide range of military use vehicles.
That's great news for us.
Yeah, because, you know, again, you're diversifying the portfolio.
There you go.
Right?
That's it.
And then who does that benefit? Ultimately, obviously, it benefits the companies, but it's going to benefit us.
Us, too. Yeah.
People in this community that work for these companies.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I am going to sell you this pen.
Okay. You're going to sell me the pen?
I'm going to sell you this pen on the other side. And if we don't go into the 8 o'clock hour with you being a tried and true... If we don't get into the 8 o'clock hour without you wearing a scarf and chanting, soccer slogans.
FIFA shirt on.
I don't know what to do for you. It's coming up on JR Morning.
Michigan summers mean outdoor adventure and fun, but high temperatures shouldn't break your budget. Count on Consumers Energy to help you make the most of this season and your budget with tips and ways to save. Making small changes like shifting some energy use to the morning or evening and raising your thermostat a couple of degrees. Doing laundry at night or on the weekends can help you lower your bill while keeping your home comfortable. Discover more ways to beat the heat at consumersenergy.com/summer.
All right, here's your chance to win a trip to see Lionel Richie and Earth, Wind & Fire in the city of your choice. And we've got your flights, hotel, concert tickets, premium VIP lounge access covered. It's your chance to sing along all night long with Lionel Richie and Earth, Wind & Fire, prize provided by Live Nation. Texas Hour's national keyword, soul, to 95819. That's S-O-U-L to 95819. We'll text you back to confirm your entry. Data and messaging rates may apply. Please don't text and drive. Play four times each weekday for four chances to win. Official rules and more are at WJR.com.
I want this to be the whole segment. Keep going, Lloyd.
Earth, Wind, Fire, and Lloyd.
And Lloyd! All right.
Okay, go ahead. Okay, I'm sorry. I love that group.
You know, you're just filibustering, so we don't get to this. I know exactly what you're doing.
This guy knows me.
Exactly what you're doing.
He knows me very well.
I know what you're doing.
Okay.
All right. Have you been watching? Thank you, Jason. Thank you. That's good. Good. All right. Have you been watching any World Cup soccer?
A little bit.
Be honest.
A little bit. I have. A little bit.
Is that like 5 minutes?
Just about.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Uh-huh.
Look, the games I love.
Okay.
I love soccer. So, of course, I'm going to like I like this.
Yeah.
I love the national pride that comes out.
I love the crowds and how they react to these games. It's just off the chain.
Okay. Well, I'm going to make an argument for this.
Okay.
And it's not necessarily the game, but it's the fans.
Okay.
That have traveled from around the globe
mm-hmm.
to be here on this continent
mm-hmm.
and to be a part of these games.
And experience some things that they haven't experienced.
Correct.
I get that.
Like this. How about Scottish fans?
Okay.
Singing this song in a bar. Singing the U.S. national anthem.
I'm impressed.
Okay, the Scottish fans are out of their minds, by the way.
Okay.
These people are out of their minds. They are drinking bars dry.
I heard something about, like, some bars, like, ran out of...
They're running out of beer.
Yeah.
They're like, we had to go to a grocery store somewhere far away to go buy 30 cases of Sam Adams because we are literally out of beer.
Wow.
These people are out of their minds.
What they do in Scotland?
There's a lot of drinking in Scotland.
Okay.
They get after it.
Okay.
A little bit. Yeah, they get after it. But it's the atmosphere. It's what they're generating.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how about the French friends in Times Square?
See, that's what I'm saying, man. They are just, the fans are just.
Here's the other part of it, too.
Okay.
Is they're talking about America. Like, they think America's this bad place, guns, political divisiveness.
Yeah.
And these fans are like, have you guys ever had avocado toast at Dunkin'? They're like, this is the craziest thing. This guy's like, I had nachos today. I don't know what that is, but it was delicious.
Who are those two guys that were up north
a few months ago?
Jason.
Yeah, and they tried Coney and all that.
Yeah.
Like, what are we doing with our lives?
Correct. Correct. I love this interview as well. I'll try to play it here. This is an English fan being interviewed by a news reporter in Texas.
I love this beer in this country, by the way. It's really good.
You like the beer in this country? All right.
Hospitality has been amazing as well.
Really? Have you had any Texas barbecue yet?
I had Texas barbecue yesterday. I had a lovely bit of brisket.
Tell me about it. What was your experience? Is it what you expected?
I went fatty. Do you go fatty or lean?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I went fatty. I went to slow fatty. Bone, okay. Picked it up, put the sauce on it, dropped it in the mouth, melted in my mouth. It was absolutely beautiful. It's the best beef I've had in my life.
Really? Yeah, yeah. We love to hear that. Did you try any of the other fixins with it or no?
I had a pork chop. I had some pork ribs. Okay. I had mac and cheese. The mac and cheese was average though.
Oh, yikes.
And the other thing is, what's this Brussels sprouts gratin about? We have Brussels sprouts at Christmas in England. Why do you have it on your barbecue? I don't know.
I don't know. There's so many questions here. Yeah. Tell me what you're doing today. You're heading into Texas Live right now. What's the plan ahead of the match?
We're going to get drunk before the game. We're going to get drunk during the game. And then we get drunk after the game. But all that matters is England wins today.
I got a new drop.
But then again, all these fans have different traditions, different chants, different things.
Okay.
How about this, the Norwegian fans? This is their rowing chant.
Sounds like the Vikings or
yes,
something.
Yes, that's what it is.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Big drums. Right. And then they all lean back, pull their arms back like they're rowing.
Like they're rowing.
Yes.
Yeah. There's a metal band from Norway that does this.
Okay.
They don't do a mosh pit. They do a rowing
pit.
Everybody sits down and you row.
Gotcha.
In the Netherlands, they do this chant where they all stand up and they kind of like wave. They kind of like lean to one side and then they shimmy to the other side. Here's what that sounds like. I love it.
I mean, I'm going to tell you, Chris, that makes me really, it kind of changed my opinion on some things.
I'm telling you.
You know, it's more than just the game.
It is more than just the game. It is for sure more than the games. And by the way, the games have been fantastic.
Okay.
I mean, like all the stars are showing up.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Making goals.
Lionel Messi had a hat trick.
Yeah.
The other night.
Oh, right.
These are the people that you want to see play on the biggest stages, wearing their country's colors, and it's just this national pride. And unfortunately, the United States soccer isn't as big of a deal.
Yeah.
Right? But it's just like anything. It's like you put those colors on, and it's totally different. Let me play one other thing. Again, reactions from people from around the world being in the United States. These are some thoughts on America.
I'm in awe of the United States of America.
I'm in America. When they say everything in America is big, I understand it. Why the hell is this quesadilla the size of my head? And I've got three of them.
Americans, you are so lucky.
Whoa. And you take your fingers and you lift that up and you eat it.
Okay.
Not with a fork.
He's nothing telling somebody how to eat ribs properly.
Okay.
To the USA.
Chick-fil-A for the first time as a family.
Chick-fil-A. Cheers.
Oh, damn.
Woman walking alone with fancy handbags, jewelry on, glasses on, they're not being harassed, nothing. If there was South Africa, gosh, first of all, I wouldn't be able to walk through this Blumen Park by myself.
Everything just big, ginormous, extra large.
That is hilarious, man.
So you need to get on board, my friend.
I got to get on board.
All right, I sold him the pen. 8 o'clock hour coming up. It's JR Morning.
We're going to get drunk before the game. We're going to get drunk during the game. And then we're going to get drunk after the game.
All right, 8 o'clock hour. Good to have you. The Memorandum of Understanding between the United States and Iran was signed by the president yesterday. And there are a number of pieces in this. Like the U.S. and Iran and allies agreed to permanently end military operations. The U.S. and Iran agree to respect each other's sovereignty and territorial integrity. The U.S. and Iran will commit to negotiating and reaching a final deal within 60 days unless mutually extended. So there is a little runway there. But the United States will also begin removing the naval blockade. And that will the president said that should be over by this week. Iran will use its best efforts to ensure safe passage for commercial vessels through the Strait of Hormuz.
Okay.
Iran will use its best efforts. How about you
just
don't do anything in the Strait of Hormuz?
There you go. Right.
It's odd language. The U.S. and regional partners will develop a mutually agreed plan of at least $300 billion for Iran's reconstruction and economic development. That caught my eye yesterday because the president was saying that not a dime of U.S. taxpayer dollars will be going towards Iran. But we don't know exactly where that $300 billion will come from. Also, the U.S. will work to terminate all types of sanctions against Iran, including the UN, the IAEA, primary and secondary sanctions. There will also be a lifting of different frozen assets that have been frozen. So that is going to be now fully open for the Iranians. It was a strange memorandum of understanding. I think there was a bit of capitulation here on behalf of the United States. The president even said yesterday that he wanted to prevent economic catastrophe. So rather than possibly going into a depression, rather than having your favorite president be Herbert Hoover, he was always one that I didn't want to be. I didn't want to see an economic catastrophe. If you keep going, that could have happened. But all I know is every time we talked about the possibility of peace, the stock market shot up like a rocket ship, is what the president said yesterday. So I don't know how else to read into that, except for the fact that he felt like there was economic pressure here, and maybe it was time to just make a deal.
He also talked about the, ballistic missiles. You know, before he was like, you know, they got to go. Rubio says they got to go. We got to get rid of them, the launchers, everything. But now he's saying, well, you know, maybe they can have some because everybody else in the region is going to have them. Why can't they have some too?
So we'll be working on a parallel effort with the Gulf nations to address non-nuclear issues such as the conventional ballistic missiles, which we'll be talking about, and support. I mean, they have to have some because other people have some. You got to have some. Somebody said, you shouldn't give them one. I mean, I have guys, I like some of these guys. But I don't think they're smart. Sir, you shouldn't let them have any missile. I said, well, what am I going to do? Am I going to let Saudi Arabia have missiles, but they can't have them? Yes, sir. Doesn't work that way, you know? It doesn't work that way. And missiles aren't the problem. Missiles are, they hurt a little location, but they don't blow up the planet.
One of the things that I made note of yesterday was Marco Rubio's facial expressions behind the president.
Dude, yes.
I mean, Marco Rubio is the one who went out in March and said, yeah, no, we're exactly. A no-go on the ballistic missiles
yes,
for Iran.
And his face did not, his face stayed.
It looked.
Yeah.
It didn't look great.
No, it did not.
It looked like somebody who was not in agreement with this. Oh, we haven't heard from him yet.
That might have been the person the president was talking about.
Maybe. Yeah, man. Good point.
You know what
good
I mean?
Good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, fair point. Mm-hmm. But again, this isn't the final deal. I was reading a lot of stories about the JCPOA and how this compares to this.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we can compare yet. Look, I'm disappointed in this MOU.
Yeah.
I don't think this is at all what we expected it to be. But it isn't the final deal.
No.
It's a framework for this next 60 days. I think then we can look at comparisons and side-by-sides and see what the final details of this are.
Yeah.
But I don't think we're at that point yet.
Well, and then too, I mean, this is a different time when the JCPOA was done. Mm-hmm. It was a different time. And I think things changed.
Yeah, I mean, it was in development in 2012 through 2015.
Exactly. And I think things changed after October 7th.
Probably. Yeah, that's a fair point.
I think some things changed.
Yeah, fair.
Toledo police say a 20-year-old man has been arrested in connection with that mass shooting at the Old West End Festival that left a dozen people injured earlier this month. Officials say Kenai Taylor was taken into custody Wednesday in Columbus, Ohio, and is facing 11 counts of felonious assault. He was wanted in connection with the June 6th shooting when gunfire erupted during the popular festival, sent 12 people to area hospitals. Authorities say 9 of the victims have since been released, while the remaining 3 are in good to stable condition. Investigators say several people have been identified as persons of interest, and they've obtained a photo of a possible second shooter. Police say Taylor will be returned to Toledo to face prosecution. A Detroit family is demanding accountability after a lawsuit alleges a police officer opened fire into a crowded block party, shooting a teenager in the head and leaving her permanently disabled. The complaint filed in Wayne County Circuit Court names Detroit police officer Verona Shaw and accuses her of gross negligence during a June 1st, 2024 response to reports of gunfire on the city's west side. According to the lawsuit, Shaw entered a backyard party without a flashlight, confronted a suspected armed gunman, then slipped on concrete steps and fired multiple rounds into the crowd while trying to regain her footing. 4 people were struck, including 19-year-old Rain Williams, who suffered a gunshot wound to the head and shoulder, later a stroke that left her immobile and nonverbal. Another victim, Imani Peterson, died weeks after the shooting. Attorneys for Williams say body camera and forensic evidence show Shaw was the only officer firing. They also say that she has since returned to duty while the family continues to seek answers and justice.
Mm. The Luigi Mangione case continues on. Of course, he was he's the man accused of shooting UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson in New York back in 2024. He is preparing to use a psychiatric defense in his upcoming state murder trial. A judge revealed that Mangione's legal team plans to argue that he was suffering from, quote, extreme emotional disturbance at the time of that killing. And it's just, we know he did it,
yeah,
right?
I mean, we saw it.
Right. So if the only defense here is to plead insanity, maybe that's the way to go. Well, feels like it'll still be difficult.
Yeah.
But it at least according to many experts that I've seen, that feels like the most viable option for him.
And if he gets convicted in the insanity, with the insanity, he goes to a mental health institution as opposed to a prison?
Well, so I guess technically this is a little different. Psychiatric defense and an insanity defense are different. It doesn't absolve guilt,
okay,
but it serves as a mitigating factor. So I was just reading a story that said the murder charge could be reduced to manslaughter under this.
Okay.
Again, still an uphill climb.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of the evidence surrounding that doesn't lead to necessarily somebody who's going under a psychiatric episode.
Right.
Feels like he was very well aware and calculated and coordinated in carrying out this murder.
And I'm sure the prosecution kind of felt that could be a possibility. They'll be ready.
Correct. Yes. Yes. Exactly right.
Yeah.
Coming up on the other side, we continue to talk about this MOU, this Memorandum of Understanding that was signed between the United States and Iran. Will it last? It's next on JR Morning. So one of the pieces in this memorandum of understanding is there is a 60-day window now that things have kicked off.
Yes.
And within that 60 days, we should get a deal. But there is a provision that if both sides agree that there needs to be an extension, they can extend.
So if negotiations are going well.
That's what the president says. If negotiations are going, no negotiations are going well, then they'll extend it.
But if not, he'll just drop a bomb on their head.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. So fine enough. Okay. But after, weeks and weeks and weeks of negotiations to even get to this point, the skepticism of this memorandum of understanding is high. It's high for me. And what exactly is the chances of this lasting or holding or getting to a point where, I feel differently about this, or you may feel differently about this. Mm-hmm. Let's talk to Peter D. Johnson. He's an expert in negotiations, author of Negotiating with Trump, Lessons on Power, Influence, and Dealing with Extreme Bargainers. Peter, good morning. It's good to have you.
Good morning, Chris and Lloyd. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, let's dig into your expertise here. Yesterday, we got the verbiage of what this memorandum of understanding is. We know that Donald Trump views himself as a master negotiator. Do you think that came through in this deal?
That's a good question. I would say if the president has put himself in a corner with this deal, obviously through his actions with Iran. And what I do in negotiating with Trump is explore all of his strengths and weaknesses across his 60 years of deal making. And I would say this isn't completely unfamiliar to Trump. He's obviously made mistakes before, and his aggressive fixed pie, what we call it in the negotiation field, approach to negotiation it undermines him, where he assumes that it's a win-lose proposition from the start. And therefore, just as what's happened here, he can lose when he misplays his cards. And he did in this case on behalf of the nation. I don't know about his personal interests. They may well have been satisfied in terms of providing a distraction away from the Epstein files, for example, and a weak domestic economy. But overall, he certainly falls into mistakes like this based on his history. He also does a lot of things well in more informal negotiations. Formal deals like this are not his forte, ironically or not. So that's what I would say in terms of the president. I'd also say that this deal, I wouldn't get too fussed about it because it's not going to last. This deal is dead on arrival in terms of the longer term. You talked about the 60 days getting beyond that. Finally, it may be extended, but ultimately we know this deal is doomed to failure for two reasons. One is how it was reached under duress for Iran and attacks, lack of trust. The people at the table didn't have the expertise to negotiate this deal. And they didn't include a lot of key players who will be required to keep this deal in place and the peace over time, including Israel. So that's one thing we know was a flaw, the how. The what, I would just say why this deal won't last in terms of U.S. interests is Iran is going to pursue its nuclear weapon one way or the other. Would you, after two unprovoked attacks in the last 9 months, say, yeah, sure, we'll give up our nuclear arms? And secondly, they learned over the last number of months that they have a superpower. And why would you give up that superpower, which is how they can put a stranglehold on the world economy through the Strait of Hormuz?
Peter, one of the themes in your book is that the president understands human psychology exceptionally well. What are some of the psychological principles he uses most effectively?
That's a great question. I talk about a whole range of psychology the president uses. Two in particular to that question. One is that he's anchored people to an impression of him, a first impression. We are very much, and I go into the details of this in the book, but we're very much driven by our first impressions, not just of people, but of things and answers. And the president has done an excellent job, starting with The Apprentice in 2004, at having people, his supporters in particular, see him as the ultimate success. To your question earlier about, is this out of character, this kind of deal? And he has given his supporters that impression of success, despite the fact that he has a myriad of failings, as we know, that are not consistent with what a successful negotiator or business person would achieve. So that's one thing. And the second thing, he projects authority, power and authority. We have a tendency to want to follow authority. He does that beautifully. And I'll ask you too this question along those lines. Have you ever seen the president in jeans?
Never.
I don't think, does he own a pair of Levi's?
I don't know if he does.
Right? And there's that's because he's incredibly aware of having that crisp, authoritative look as president, with a flag and the symbols, the trappings of authority around him, so people don't question him and they see him as an authority figure. Very powerful psychological ploy on his behalf. And the last one psychologically is he has an amazing ability to draw on a tendency we have that's called loss aversion, which means we value our losses or potential losses at twice the level of equal gains. So that means you'd have to find $40 in the street to make up for a $20 when you lose $20 in the street, because we fear loss so heavily. And the president, MAGA, Make America Great Again, is all about perceived losses. And if you don't have a loss, he'll make you think you have one in order to reinforce his ability to be an authoritative leader. And there's a link there because 40% of Americans in some polls have said they prefer an authoritarian leader in the right circumstances. And what are those circumstances? They're people thinking that they're losing something or about to lose something, in which case they want a powerful leader like Trump to protect them. And when you combine that fear of loss with power and authority, and how he's anchored people to think he's such a success, you get Donald Trump being elected twice, negotiating his way to power.
Peter, we just have 30 seconds left here. I want to go back to something you said about the people negotiating this deal not being the best people to do it. Were these talks then doomed from the beginning, do you think?
Yes. In a word. I'm not dissing these people.
Sure.
But when you look at J.D. Vance and you look at Steve Witkoff, real estate developer, Jared Kushner,
right.
Investment guy. I'm not saying they're not competent negotiators
sure.
in their field,
sure.
but to bring them into this complexity with so many issues, and the president is
right.
well overseeing this, giving directives, this was doomed from
the start. Well, we can't wait to read the book. It is Negotiating with Trump, Lessons on Power, Influence, and Dealing with Extreme Bargainers. Peter D. Johnson, thank you for your time. We appreciate it. I hope we talk again soon.
Thank you so much, Chris and Lloyd. Have a great day to you and your listeners.
You as well.
Do
the same. More next. So our friends at our sister station at the Big 1050 WTKA in Ann Arbor, they are having their Mott Takeover Radiothon today. And it's happening now until 3 o'clock this afternoon. And they are raising funds for the Charles Woodson Clinical Research Fund at the University of Michigan Health, C.S. Mott Children's Hospital. And they have done incredible work over the years. Over 9,500 donors have made gifts to the Charles Woodson Clinical Research Fund. $2.6 million in research funding has been provided as well. Over $1 million to the lab infrastructure, $1.6 million toward recruitment and retention. I mean, the money that has come in from this.
It's huge.
It goes so far for an institution that already does so much.
Yes, C.S. Mott, man. Oh, my God.
But I think one of the things that I take from this is the love that these former players have for their alma mater, where they really started their careers.
Sure, absolutely.
The fact that they continue to come back.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. Ira Weintraub is the host of the Michigan Insider Radio Show and joins us this morning. Ira, good morning. It's good to have you.
It's great to be here on one of the great days that we have at WTKA here in Ann Arbor.
Well, let's talk about it. I mean, there is obviously this money goes so far, but it's the community's involvement. It's these former players that come back to give their time to raise this money for C.S. Mott.